The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Tempest over a terror trade, how the swap of five top Taliban for one GI squares with U.S. law and Afghan policy, plus the VA, Putin, and D-Day diplomacy.
War against coal or for the environment, weighing the cost in jobs and prices and benefits to health, climate, and alternative energy.
Medical opinions of the people, by the people, for the people, how TV's Dr. McDreamy is helping to crowdsource difficult diagnoses.
Cruise to the Edge. That's Tom Cruise in The Edge of Tomorrow and other recent releases.
Till I Get It Right. Stage and TV star Emily Bergel's new cabaret show recalls the roller coaster of seeking love and the ups and downs of finding it.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of June 7th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. He would put this mask on, but behind it was a shattered version of the man I knew. That was Susan Ullman on her husband, a four-tour Special Forces veteran of the Afghan War, who turned to drink and domestic violence before killing himself, one of a rising tide of such Special Forces suicides, nearly 50 in the last 2.5 years. Now this.
This morning, I called Bob and Janie Bergdahl and told them that after nearly 5 years in captivity, their son, Bo, is coming home.
He served the United States with honor and distinction.
He wrote to his parents, quote, "I have seen their ideas about his commanding officers, and I am ashamed to even be American. The horror of the self-righteous arrogance that they thrive in, it is all revolting."
This is a pattern of behavior by this White House. He believes somehow that he's become a monarch or an emperor that can basically ignore the law and do whatever he wants.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Even the stirring memories of D-Day in Normandy, launched by General Dwight Eisenhower 70 years ago last week, could not quiet the military diplomatic muddle launched days earlier by President Obama with a surprise announcement he had traded five top Taliban from Guantanamo for the last American hostage in Afghanistan. It did not help that National Security Advisor Susan Rice used heroic terms to describe Sergeant Bo Bergdahl after years of published reports that he actually left his post under controversial circumstances, or that Obama failed to give congressional leaders the 30-day notice required for a Guantanamo release, as noted by Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio.
The first administration claim was that speed was essential because of Bergdahl's failing health. Then secrecy was cited as essential to keep him from being killed by some of his terrorist captors not on board with the deal. Overshadowed by the debate on whether Bergdahl was worth it were suggestions he might have been at least in part a collateral beneficiary of longstanding U.S. efforts to open lines to the Taliban and shape some political role for them in Afghanistan after U.S. forces are all but gone. To consider all this, current diplomacy at last week's D-Day events and related issues, for your ears only, we're joined again by Lawrence J. Korb, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Welcome back to the program.
Nice to be with you again.
Was this swap at least in part about resuming communication with the Taliban, giving them a dramatic exchange to video, maybe as much as about getting Bergdahl back?
Well, I think that was part of it because, as you know, about 3 years ago, we tried to start negotiations with the Taliban, and then Karzai did not like the fact that the image they were portraying as co-equals with him. But at some point, you're going to have to negotiate with the Taliban, whether it's us or the Karzai or Abdullah government, because they're going to have a role in the future of Afghanistan.
Was this also a way of getting something in return for further reducing the prisoner population in Guantanamo, to which Obama says he's committed and which might have to be done anyway once major U.S. forces depart Afghanistan?
Right. When the war ends, and, you know, you can say it's 2014 or 2016, depending upon how you view it, I mean, but all of our troops will be out by 2016. We'll end our combat role at the end of this year. According to lawyers like John Bellinger, who was a lawyer for President Bush's National Security Council, and Jay Johnson, who was the general counsel at DOD, who's now a Secretary of Homeland Security, when that combat ends, you've got to give these prisoners back. And these prisoners are about the one-third. There's one-third you can transfer, one-third you can try. They're the one-third you can't try because they didn't do anything to us. They're just horrible people that we grab when we first went in there.
Does returning those former Taliban leaders significantly increase the danger to U.S. forces remaining in Afghanistan or encourage more hostage-taking there or elsewhere?
No, I mean, that to me is really a straw man. They've been out of touch with the people fighting and the tactics and everything for 13 years. As I told someone, it'd be like bring Michael Jordan to the NBA playoffs and say, okay, get back in there and start guarding LeBron. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. So it's really not. And the same way, I mean, they've been killing Americans, and you say, well, let's not kill them. Let's take them as a hostage. No, I mean, that's nonsense.
How do you explain Susan Rice's heroic description of a GI long shadowed by charges of desertion? Did the administration feel it had to make him seem more valuable for the U.S. audience or for the Taliban?
I don't think so. I think she was a little over the top. I mean, you know, basically, it was honorable. He did volunteer at the height of the war. Things were not going well in Iraq and Afghanistan when he joined, and certainly that was honorable. But then to say he served with distinction, given what they knew, because there was a report done right after he was captured by the Taliban that raised a lot of questions.
Let's go back to the D-Day anniversary, where European leaders defied Obama's wishes to keep Russian President Vladimir Putin isolated, and where Obama himself has a 15-minute session with Putin. What impact do you see on pro-Russian provocation in Ukraine?
Well, I think it's important anytime you can communicate. I mean, we communicated with the Soviet leaders at the height of the Cold War. Eisenhower invited Khrushchev here to the United States right after they were in, Hungary and Poland. Nixon started negotiating with them right after what they did in Czechoslovakia. So, no, I don't think that that's a problem. I mean, the Soviets/Russians, they had 9 million people killed in World War II. They bore much more of the brunt of fighting than we did. So I think, we should work on them at issues we can. They're helping us in and out of Afghanistan. We've got a nuclear treaty. They've been very helpful with Iran. So I think you got to focus on areas where you can work with them.
D-Day also was the background last week for a bipartisan proposal to help a growing number of veterans from the wars that followed World War II to get around overwhelmed medical resources and suspect management, you have to say, at the Veterans Administration. The VA would pay for private health care. What's your view of that?
Well, I think this is something we should have been doing, and I'm glad that Senator McCain, working with Bernie Sanders, who's the chairman of Senate Veterans Committee, but Bernie's been proposing some of these for a while. They've been filibustered, so I think, yes, we need to do it because two things happen. One, about 50% of the people leaving active duty are going to the VA, which is much higher than previous wars. The other is that General Shinseki, when he came in, allowed Vietnam veterans to get help as they get older and things happen because it could have been Agent Orange. We don't know that for a fact. But I think those two things really overwhelm the system. And, people say, well, you should get more doctors. Doctors aren't going to go work for half of what they can make in the private sector, in the numbers that you need.
Do you think that Shinseki's removal was necessary only because of political pressure or to really reform the VA?
Well, I think given the way he handled it, he was hurting more than he was helping toward the end. I think he was trying to fix the problem and, got caught up in some of the things that I've talked about. I mean, for example, they said, well, you should have fired those people. We didn't have the authority to fire them. And given his demeanor, I think a lot of people lost confidence in his ability. I think he recognized that it probably will be better for veterans in the long run.
Lawrence J. Korb, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, is now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Quote from the news, it still kind of bothers me. That was Navajo Indian Chester Nez on all the years of pressure not to speak his native language until it became the basis for his secret code talking in World War II. He died last week at age 93.
Next, from war in Europe and Afghanistan to the so-called war on coal, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It seems like the best report money can buy. That was Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal on the GM internal investigation that blamed an irresponsible corporate culture for the 10-year delay in recalling cars with flawed ignition switches linked to at least 13 deaths and led to the firing of 15 company employees last week, but cleared current President Mary T. Barra, a longtime GM executive, and her top aides. Now this.
The administration has set out to kill coal and its 800,000 jobs. If it succeeds in death by regulation, we'll all be paying a lot more money for electricity if we can get it.
I don't think there's any war on coal at all. What this is a realization that the climate is changing, that carbon dioxide emissions have an impact on that, and that the largest source of carbon emissions is from coal-fired power plants.
Wyoming's Republican Senator Mike Enzi and Kentucky's Democratic Congressman John Yarmuth had predictably partisan differences of opinion about the tougher new limits on power plant emissions and other carbon controls proposed by the administration as executive actions to sidestep congressional paralysis.
Even supporters of the new standards admit they will cause economic and employment disruptions, but they note offsetting benefits as well. And at least 10 states already have cut carbon emissions by the 30% President Obama proposed. Veteran journalist Tom Zeller, Jr., a specialist on the intersection of science and politics, reviewed the pros and cons for the Bloomberg View. And for your ears only, he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
Let's start with the administration sidestepping Congress. What are the prospects for this executive action standing up in court?
You know, on the one hand, EPA is turning to a rather seldom used provision in the Clean Air Act in order to make these rules. And that's the basis for opponents' arguments going forward. They argue that that provision doesn't give them the authority to make these sorts of sweeping rules. On the flip side, though, courts have traditionally found in favor of the EPA in past challenges to related rules. So there's some reason to expect that the courts will uphold this authority as well, though it's going to take a long time to sort that out.
And what do the most recent polls say about public sentiment on the kinds of controls Obama has proposed?
Well, there's lots of evidence that the public supports these measures. I looked at just one survey conducted by Yale University, and the numbers were pretty straightforward. There was something like, I think it was something like 64% of respondents support regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant, even if it meant that their electricity bills would go up. And, you know, of course, if you break that down along partisan lines, it changes a bit. But even when they asked if you just simply supported regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant, that number was 68%, and I think it even included like 60% of Republicans. So there's clear support for this idea.
Let's talk more about costs. The Chamber of Commerce last week predicted even greater losses than Senator Enzi in jobs and energy expenses in the long term. Remind us.
I think they predicted something like $51 billion on average every year would be lost in GDP. To over 200,000 fewer jobs every year through 2030, a huge loss in disposable income. Over $500 billion was predicted by the chamber.
And the American Petroleum Institute was even more apocalyptic about the prospects for U.S. business if the EPA should target similar executive action against other polluting chemicals. Remind us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So those rules have to do with the emissions of chemicals related to ground-level ozone. The American Petroleum Institute published a report suggesting that pretty much every community in the United States would suffer economic hardship if these rules were put into place. I think they call them, quote, the costliest EPA regulations ever. I think I have that right.
On the other hand, we've heard pessimistic predictions like this in the past, notably in the 1970s when the Clean Air Act took aim at automobile emissions. What were the warnings then? What actually happened?
Well, they read almost verbatim to the warnings that you hear now. You know, I wrote about an example from the auto industry warning in 1970 that cars would no longer be produced, that people would not be able to have cars within 5 years. And the same arguments were made when the Clean Water Act was introduced in 72, the Endangered Species Act, the Montreal Protocol in 1987. And yet over, you know, since 1970, gross domestic product has increased by something like 200%. Vehicle miles traveled have increased by 167%. We've added 88% more private sector jobs while cutting pollution. So, you know, I think the numbers sort of speak for themselves on that front.
And you note that the doomsayers often ignore the cost of not controlling pollution in terms of health care and lost workdays, quite apart from global warming.
Yeah, that's a whole other side of it that doesn't really get quantified, and partly because it's difficult to do. But there's no question that reducing illnesses associated with air pollution have ancillary benefits that I think the complaints often fail to take into account. One study that I cited in the piece that I wrote suggested that these regulations since 1990 had prevented some 160,000 premature deaths, 100,000 heart attacks, millions of cases of bronchitis. And other folks have tried to put dollar values on that. One study from the Harvard School of Public Health estimated maybe as much as $500 billion just attributed to the cost of coal making us sick. So, and of course, those estimates don't even include the impacts of global warming and other pollution impacts. So it's almost certainly higher than that.
Critics of the new carbon constraints say they amount to picking favorites in the alternative energy field. But what might that mean for creation of new jobs and ultimately cheaper energy from free sources like the sun and wind if they gain momentum?
Yeah, well, it makes sense that as it becomes harder and more costly for power generators to dump carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a lot of investment will be driven towards finding either technologies that can prevent that CO2 from getting out before it's released or alternatives to fuels that produce CO2 in the first place. And so there's almost certain that these regulations will drive more investment and certainly more jobs in that area. It's also worth noting that the nuclear industry is very excited about these new rules, too, being a low-carbon fuel source. Certainly, nuclear is pulling out all the stops and creating a big lobbying campaign to identify itself as a low-carbon option. Nuclear power, although, is an extremely expensive investment. So if I were a betting person, I mean, I don't know how things will spin, I would see more investment going towards renewable technologies.
You also say the traditional energy industry might have had an easier time now if they had not opposed earlier administration legislative proposals on carbon.
Yeah, well, it's a question worth raising. Folks will remember that a comprehensive climate bill was an intense focus of Congress when Obama first came into office. And by 2009, legislation had actually passed in the House. It ultimately died in the Senate for a variety of reasons, but among them was opposition from the same industry groups that we're hearing from now. And it's arguable that that House bill that passed, which had a lot of concessions from for industry, might have been easier to deal with. But that's ancient history now.
Veteran journalist Tom Zeller, Jr. is a specialist on the intersection of science and politics for the Bloomberg View.
Here's a quote from the news. At a certain point, I thought I would explode, but I knew that even if I used my loudest voice, I would just disappear in a minute. That was Tiananmen Square protest veteran Xiao Fengso, surprised that he was permitted to return for its 25th anniversary, but sure he could not overcome the government crackdown on any outward observance of an event many young Chinese don't even know about.
Next, TV's Dr. McDreamy and crowdsourcing real-world diagnoses for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, a great big zero. That was Secretary of State John Kerry on the overwhelming but questionable re-election victory of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, as Washington's latest promise of more aid to rebel forces remained to be fleshed out. We've consistently been behind the curve, said Robert Ford, who recently resigned as U.S. ambassador in Damascus. Now this.
You need a little spice in your life, man. I'm just trying to help.
I am truly a worse human being for knowing you.
We could work through sleeping with each other's wives and significant others.
Hey, Dad, want to get a drink?
Actor Patrick Dempsey plays Eric Dr. McDreamy Shepherd to Eric Dane's Mark Dr. Steamy Sloan on TV's Grey's Anatomy. But Dempsey has taken on real-life medical missions as well. After his mother died of ovarian cancer, the actor created the Patrick Dempsey Cancer Center for Hope and Healing. And now he's broadened his efforts with an investment in CrowdMed, an internet platform that seeks mass wisdom to diagnose rare and mysterious diseases.
Launched only last year, CrowdMed reports solving more than 200 cases in months instead of years, 50 times faster than the traditional U.S. medical system, at a cost of just hundreds of dollars as against $100,000 or more. Now, to say more about crowdsourcing medical wisdom and the Dempsey connection, for Your Ears Only, CrowdMed CEO Jared Hyman joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Catherine. Good to be here.
Your background is not in medicine, but technology and finance. How did CrowdMed come to be?
Well, my inspiration for starting CrowdMed was actually my little sister, Carly, who spent 3 years with a terrible, undiagnosed medical mystery. It could have killed her. Fortunately, she did survive long enough to get a diagnosis. And once she had that correct diagnosis and treatment plan, she returned to health pretty quickly. But, you know, she saw almost two dozen doctors during that period, racked up six-figure medical bills, and really suffered quite a bit. And this inspired me to do something to help people with unsolved medical mysteries like my sister.
And what made you think that the internet and crowdsourcing was the way to come up with diagnoses that the traditional doctors couldn't?
The previous company that I founded is an online survey company called InfoServe. And at InfoServe, I learned quite a bit about the wisdom of crowds. And that's this notion that large groups of individuals can be much smarter than individual experts. So between my passion for solving medical mysteries and my unique appreciation of how wise crowds could be, I thought that it was kind of silly that in the medical system, we rely upon individual experts to solve these very difficult mysteries when crowds collectively, with their collective intuition, collective knowledge, can be much smarter than individual experts. So I applied all that I knew about crowd wisdom and ways of harnessing it in order to create CrowdMed and use this phenomenon to solve tough medical cases.
How big is your community of so-called medical detectives? Who are they and with what kind of real expertise?
We've had about 2,000 medical detectives log into the site over the last few months. Almost 300 of them are currently active on the site, participating in patient cases. And in terms of their profile, we have a philosophy at CrowdMed where we screen our medical detectives not based upon their formal credentials, but rather their performance. So just about anyone can register for the site, but in order to have much influence and in order to really be able to affect the results of a patient, you have to prove your worth. So it is a performance-based system where those medical detectives who prove most adept at solving cases, they get more status, more privileges, more influence on the site. That being said, it is certainly a medically oriented group. So about 60% of our medical detectives either work in or study medicine. This is mostly doctors, medical school students. We have nurse practitioners, chiropractors, people from a wide variety of different medical backgrounds. The other 40% are often lay people, but these are people that usually have a deep expertise around particular illnesses due to their own personal experience. So, for example, my sister ended up being diagnosed with a very rare disease called FXPOI, and she knows more about FXPOI than the vast majority of doctors out there. So we want to be able to let people like my sister and other patients who have deep expertise around particular illnesses participate on the site as well to capture their unique insights and knowledge.
Well, beyond patients' symptoms, what kind of information do they provide about their medical histories and lifestyles?
Well, we believe that detectives need good clues, and we call our case solvers medical detectives. And we try to get as many clues for them as possible to really sleuth out the correct diagnosis and solution for our patients. So we have an in-depth patient questionnaire where we ask about not only symptoms, but also medical history, family medical history, lifestyle, demographics, the results of any diagnostic or imaging tests that have been done. We really try to collect a wide variety of clues from our patients, and that way there might be that one little nugget in there that really leads the detective towards the right diagnosis and treatment idea.
How do you analyze all the suggested diagnoses that come in and calculate which are the most popular or agreed upon or likely? Is there a special algorithm?
You know, we're a technology company, and that technology is really the core of what we do, developing that mechanism for separating signal and noise for collecting the consensus of the crowd and assigning accurate probabilities to the different diagnostic and solution possibilities. And we spent 2 years developing a patented prediction market algorithm. A prediction market is like a virtual stock market where people bet points on what they believe to be the best answer. And then our system can use that point betting behavior to assign these accurate probabilities.
What kind of reaction does CrowdMed or those it serves get from the traditional medical system?
You know, we've really seen a mix. First of all, the medical community is by nature quite conservative. So I think there's a certain degree of skepticism towards anything that's new. And also, it's a system that culturally is very biased towards this notion of individual expertise. So the idea of crowds doing what has traditionally been the realm of individual experts is something that a lot of medical practitioners initially meet with skepticism. That being said, once they see our results and they see how insightful and intelligent and well thought out and rational our patient results are, they say, this actually seems to produce some really good diagnostic and solution suggestions. And I should pay attention to CrowdMed results because they tend to be very high quality. So we're winning them over little by little.
Jared Hyman is CEO of CrowdMed.com, crowdsourcing medical mystery diagnosis.
Here's a quote from the news. DEA agents can be quite direct when they want to make an impression on you. That was an anonymous Massachusetts physician quoted in a Boston Globe story about pressure on doctors to break ties with medical marijuana operations legal in the state, but not under federal law.
Next, Cruise to the Edge. Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow and other recent releases for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Little catch-up for the middle class. That was AFL-CIO chief economist William Spriggs after last week's Labor Department report showing a net gain of 217,000 jobs in May and unemployment holding steady at 6.3%. That brought the total jobs back to pre-fiscal crisis levels, but mostly lower wage rates and not keeping up with population growth. Now this.
We are fighting an organism. They have the power to reset the day, and now so do you.
It's a new day, people!
How do I control it?
You have to die.
Every day. I'm not even trained for combat.
Come find me when you wake up!
The D-Day invasion to save democracy that real military units worked so hard to accurately recreate last week on its 70th anniversary is artistically altered for the new science fiction thriller Edge of Tomorrow, with Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt fighting to save all humanity and a touch of Groundhog Day deja vu.
Cruise plays a soldier who, after being killed in combat, awakens the day before the battle and must relive over and over the moment of his death until he can work out how to escape it. Sounds a little repetitious, but film critic Marshall Fine of HollywoodandFine.com and The Huffington Post calls Edge of Tomorrow the first really exciting movie of the summer. And for your ears only, he joins us again to talk about it, as well as some other recent releases. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
Original and invigorating were two words you used to describe Edge of Tomorrow. How is the alien invasion that begins it different from all other alien invasions?
Well, you don't really see this alien invasion. It's more that you hear about it on the news. It's like a cable news network roundup. You know, if you've just joined us, here's what's happening now. And we're brought up to date on the fact that aliens have invaded Europe. They're on the shores getting ready to invade England, and look out.
And how does Cruise's character change throughout the film as he continues to recycle himself?
Well, he starts out as a coward. He's basically a recruiting officer, a public relations guy who's on TV telling everybody, come on, you know, join the fight, you know, save humanity. But then he finds out that, in fact, they're putting him on the front line so they can film him on during the invasion to use as a recruiting tool. And he's going, wait a minute, I'm not trained for combat. I don't want to do this. The next thing you know, he tases him and he wakes up getting ready to go into combat.
Cruise has been a major star for more than three decades now. Does he still have the chops and charm to tackle all the action required, or at least look like he's tackling it?
Well, I wish I looked that good at that age. He's in amazing shape, and he's completely believable as someone who figures out how to become a soldier. He hasn't lost a step. I don't know how old Tom Cruise is. I think he's in his early 50s. But boy, you know, he doesn't look like he's much past his mid-30s.
And remind us about Emily Blunt's career. Was this her first major action movie, and how does she handle it?
Well, it's funny. She was quoted at one point saying she'd rather do little independent films than be a spear carrier in some Tom Cruise action film. Here she is. She's the action babe who's kicking butt and taking names. She's the one who teaches him how to be a soldier, and she really carries it off. You know, given that she's done a lot of these little independent films where she's played Queen Victoria as a young woman and other characters like that, this is a big change of pace for her, and she carries it off admirably.
The Fault in Our Stars is not about space or aliens. You call it a well-made movie that earns its tears. What's the plot?
It's young people who are dying and who fall in love with each other. In this case, two teenagers who both have cancer who meet and fall for each other. One is played by Shailene Woodley. She's had cancer since she was 13, is, you know, doesn't have much of a prognosis for a future. The other is played by Ansel Elgort. He's in remission, a former jock who lost a leg to cancer who falls for her.
Let's move on to Seth MacFarlane's comedy, A Million Ways to Die in the West, which you encourage people not to compare to Mel Brooks' classic Blazing Saddles, despite obvious comedic cowboy similarities. Does MacFarlane simply push the envelope even farther in this film?
Oh, he absolutely pushes it farther, because the standards of what counts as inappropriate these days is much different than it was in 1974 when Mel Brooks did Blazing Saddles. That movie was shocking in its time. Now it would, you know, you could play it in prime time on television. This movie is shocking, but it's also less about the jokes and more about the Westerns. Seth MacFarlane is obviously someone who loves classic Westerns, but at the same time, he's not too proud to put in a few poop jokes. Put it this way, I'm not proud of the fact that I laughed a lot at this movie, but I will admit that I did, and I enjoyed myself thoroughly.
Angelina Jolie aims to frighten in Maleficent, based on Sleeping Beauty, but you were not so charmed by it. Is it really possible for Angelina Jolie to be dull?
No, I don't think that's ever going to be the case. She's one of the most fascinating people to look at on the screen, even when she's not doing anything. But she's got to have better taste in scripts. This one is a revisionist fairy tale that casts the Wicked Witch in this one as the good guy. I didn't think it worked. I thought it was mostly an excuse for a lot of computer-generated animation. Aside from that, I think mothers and daughters will go to it and have a great time.
The latest installment of X-Men has arrived, X-Men Days of Future Past. Is it worth a viewing by other than X-Men enthusiasts, and how do you see them reacting to it?
You know, I don't know how the X-Men fans will like this. I was someone who was a fan of the early X-Men films off and on, liked the last one, the First Class. Felt like this one just they didn't know what to do with the script. They've got too complicated. It's a time travel movie that brings in past and present X-Men. Always fun, but this one just falls apart in the last half hour.
Talk about words and pictures, not a history of Hollywood movie making.
No, this is actually a romantic comedy and one of the smarter ones around, with Clive Owen and Juliette Binoche as two damaged people who are teachers at a prep school. He's a writer, she's a painter, and they get their students involved in an argument about which is more important, the image or the word. And it's a way for the two of them to sort of find common ground and fall in love. I think you'll be charmed by it.
And finally, Million Dollar Arm, starring John Hamm as a fast-talking baseball agent who has hit a rut that bounces him all the way to India. Is this a feel-good Field of Dreams with Curry on the side?
I think this is a feel-good movie. Disney really knows how to do these inspirational sports films. This one's based on a true story about a sports agent who went to India looking for cricket players who could pitch in the major leagues, and brought two of them back. It's pretty inspirational. John Hamm shows a side of himself that he doesn't show on Mad Men, one that has some feelings in a way that Don Draper never does. I think this one may not be a home run, but it's certainly a solid double.
Film critic and historian Marshall Fine. You can read his film reviews at HollywoodandFine.com and The Huffington Post.
Quote from the news, we traveled back to New York City in style in a luxury Mercedes Sprinter. Road life is a good life. That was comic Artie Fuqua on Facebook after a gig in Delaware just minutes before a horrendous six-vehicle crash that left one man dead and seven injured, including TV star Tracy Morgan, in critical condition.
Next, the roller coaster of romance in story and song. For Your Ears Only.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, "If that's not healthy, then I'll have what she's having." That was a response by supporters of Hillary Clinton to Republican suggestions she had suffered lingering damage from an earlier fall and concussion. A new memoir by the presumed Democratic presidential contender also quotes her on becoming friends with Barack Obama as like two teenagers on an awkward first date. Now this.
Something inside of me started a symphony. Sing, went the strings of my heart.
So sang the rising stage and screen star Emily Bergel in her debut cabaret show 3 years ago. But that cheery 1934 sentiment represents neither the beginning nor the end of her new show at New York's 54 Below Supper Club about the real-life roller coaster of romance, which often starts with longing and ends in loss. The show is called Till I Get It Right, after the 1973 Tammy Wynette hit. And to talk more about it and her career, from Shakespeare in Central Park to Shameless on Showtime with Hollywood in between, for your ears only, Emily Bergel is on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You were born in Britain to an English dad and an Irish mom, but grew up in Illinois, so no accent. But any memories of England as a child?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, we go over a lot because all our family's still over in England and Ireland. But the thing that I remember most was, especially back then, you really couldn't get, like, the British candy. And so I had all of my favorite sweets taken away from me at a young age. So even now to this day, when I go over to England, I'll have like 8 bags of the potato chips that I used to like as a kid.
You had several starring roles in college plays. Is that when the stage bug bit you, or were you acting even as a kid?
Oh, I was a little megalomaniac producer when I was a kid. I actually once, at 10 years old, were taught kids to play the piano and sing and organize a recital for them and all of their parents at my house. And I've actually found the programs that I made, and it's ridiculous. Like, I'm in every number. It's like, with piano by Emily Bergel, directed by Emily Bergel, catering by Emily Bergel.
You started on screen only 2 years out of Grinnell, most notably in a sequel to the...
Actually, less than a year.
You were in the Supernatural sequel to Carrie, then a lot of TV, including roles in Desperate Housewives, Men in Trees. How do you compare the difference between making movies and TV?
You know, people ask me what I prefer all the time, and I mean, I have to say that I really do enjoy both. I mean, financial compensation aside. But, you know, I think I have more control over my performance on stage, which I like. And it's more about the acting. Sometimes you're just so rushed in TV that it's just the most important thing was that the camera get it right. And it can feel sometimes that the acting is secondary.
Your cabaret career began only 3 years ago, but were you always a singer at heart?
I was always a singer at heart, and I don't know where I got this idea, but always as a young girl, I dreamed of becoming a cabaret singer, and I think it was solidified when we had a variety show in my high school, and I sang Ain't Misbehavin', and I wore this sexy dress and, you know, sat on top of the piano, and afterwards, this football player asked me out. So I think that kind of reinforced the entire thing for me.
You call your shows Nouveau Cabaret. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a term that I actually coined because I feel like I love the art form of cabaret, but I feel like it became a little kind of encased in amber, that people felt like cabaret meant that you were only doing the Great American Songbook. Now, I love the Great American Songbook, and I do several, you know, classic songs in my show, but I think there are other classics from today, from the 50s, from the 60s, from the 70s, and I think that those songs deserve that same unique cabaret treatment and focus on lyrics that the Great American Songbook does.
Let's talk about the new show, which you describe as exploring, quote, just how seductive making bad decisions can be. Say more about how you developed the idea, how much it reflects your own experience in the roller coaster of romance.
I was choosing my songs and developing the show when I was in a relationship, and I was very much in love. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, I thought that I was going to be doing this really happy show, and I ended up doing the darkest show that I've ever done. you know, in hindsight, I probably should have listened to my song choices more, because I think they were telling me a little bit about the relationship that I was in. But I feel like they're always a reflection of your subconscious. So I mean that is a part of it. But I think every cabaret show ends up to being about love to a certain degree. But I always find it fascinating when people are doing things or making decisions that are against their own best interests, but they just can't help doing it anyway. I've always find that very interesting, and I feel like a lot of songs are about that. And a lot of songs are sung, a lot of songs we know are sung in a certain way. When you look at the lyrics, you think, why are songs sung in a certain way? And so I like to really look at lyrics and especially reinvent songs that we know a certain way, but when you really listen to what the song is saying, it's a lot differently than it was.
Rising stage and screen star Emily Bergel performs her Till I Get It Right show June 10, 13, and 14 at the 54 Below Supper Club, 254 West 54th Street near Broadway in New York. Call 646-476-3551 and check out emilybergel.net.
Sometimes I think I found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All that you need.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, feedburner.com, and stitcher.com, and going back years at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hanger Studio Play It Productions. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago.
This week, to mark the 25th anniversary of China's Tiananmen massacre of youthful protesters, we go back exactly 2 years to our interview with one of that protest's leaders, now a media entrepreneur and supporter of populist Occupy activities in this country, from our June 3rd, 2012 broadcast, hosted by Eddie Robinson and me.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots.
Sounds of protest in Beijing and New York City decades apart. This week marks the 23rd anniversary of the student-led uprising and bloody government repression in Tiananmen Square, as reported by the BBC on June 4, 1989. A year later on this show, we spoke with the leader of that uprising, by then exiled and studying in the United States. His name is Shen Tong, and as we learned from another guest on this show several weeks ago, he has now become involved with the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon that we just heard reasserting itself this past May Day.
In the years between, Shen Tong has become an actor, author, tech and media entrepreneur, and social activist. Now, some thoughts about the changes he's seen and those he expects in China and the U.S. We're pleased to have Shen Tong on the line again for Your Ears Only. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
You've written about the emotional echoes of Tiananmen you felt at Zuccotti Park in New York, birthplace of Occupy. Talk about that.
Once in a while,
society is lucky enough to have a real transformative change from a grassroots social movement, and that's what I felt back in 89, and that's what I felt last fall in Zuccotti Park and in the global Occupy movement.
You also wrote that you arrived thinking your Tiananmen experience gave you something to teach the occupiers, but instead found yourself learning lessons from them about developing real democracy. Perhaps strangely for a refugee from communism, it was the importance of a communal spirit. Say more.
The Occupy movement was first and foremost a communal conversation. So it didn't take me long to realize that this is very different. Zuccotti Park wasn't Tiananmen Square. It was not a mass protest with a demand of the power that might be making certain changes. It's a weakening and civic revival of American general public. I mean, it's not only a phenomenon in America, but in America it was particularly significant, being a generally very apathetic country in the last 30, 40 years.
You make a point about that apathy as a kind of function of American individualism or the myth of American individualism. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, personally, the American individualism and the social, political, even cultural symbols associated with that was correctly understood or not, was a source of inspiration for the youth of China back in the 1980s. So it was rather surreal for me to be exiled from Tiananmen, coming here, and realize not long after my exile in the late 90s, especially, that that translated into this ultra individualism and also that the individual as a passive consumer. And news or information or commercial news, passive receiver and voter, not as a direct participant of democracy. And that's very much a source of the problem the American society is now experiencing, especially money-corrupted politics.
You're very much involved in technology and media. I wonder if you see social media working to further unite or isolate us behind our screens, large and small.
What's interesting is both. There's so much sensory overload through all the screens that we either passively watch or proactively interact with, but there's a curious lack of civic participation in the public sphere. And in the private and the social sphere, in the sense of connecting with friends, the lack of person-to-person, real engaging conversation versus rather just consumption of just lots of information. It's also curious, if not problematic. I mean, I think what activists experienced in Egypt or in other social movement, if this is true back in 89, is that technology was tremendously important to pass information, but equally important, if not more, is to person-to-person, real good old connection between individuals. And that's also true for the dynamics of the movement itself. Occupy was extremely successful in changing the national conversation by quickly using the technology and social media and come to the same sentiment, if you will, about a list of grievances. That was a very accurate and straightforward, and that's why Occupy Wall Street was successful. The problem seems to be centered on Wall Street. But then in terms of developing a sustainable movement and, say, a national organization, which requires not just technology, but also a person-to-person connection. That's where the movement is struggling now.
Let's turn to China. The blind activist Chinese lawyer Cheng Wang Cheng, who recently escaped from house arrest to the U.S. Embassy, is now a student at New York University. And last week he gave a surprisingly optimistic prognosis for democracy in China. What's your reaction?
It's a part of our DNA to be optimistic as activists. So there is that. To a large extent, it's true, because hope, as one of the most influential contemporary Chinese writer Lu Xun once wrote, that it's like a road in a wilderness. There's no road, but after some daring people keep walking into the wilderness, there will be one. So there's that. But also, I think there's a number of aspects, especially in recent years, that the social polarization in the Chinese society would certainly make any careful watcher of China wonder how the system could sustain itself.
Do you think Chen will be permitted to return, or does all the new communications technology today give him even more of a presence in China if he stays free in the U.S.?
Oh, that's hard to say. To be perfectly honest, I mean, my own experience in the last almost 24 years since my exile in mid-June 1989, it's a mixed one. The ability of keeping the voice of pro-democracy movement alive in the West certainly is a great help to sustain the dissident movement in China by being in exile and being able to do something here. But also being removed almost so completely in the public domain in China certainly is a hindrance to our effectiveness. And I think my colleague Chen and others experienced the same situation. But in my case, I managed to go back to China multiple times in the last two decades or so, and sometimes getting arrested, other times I was able to reconnect with people and also having some influence in my writing under a different name that's kind of allowed by the government. It's a more unique situation because most of the exiles are not able to return to China. It remains to be seen whether he is allowed to do that.
Shen Tong was a student leader in Tiananmen Square 23 years ago this week, now U.S. high-tech entrepreneur and social activist.
From Tiananmen to Occupy, from our June 3, 2012 broadcast. Last week's 25th anniversary of the massacre went officially unmarked in China, in fact harshly repressed and increasingly unknown to successive generations of Chinese.
In New York, Shen Tong conceded that the student leaders back then were, quote, too naive. Such a protest in a police state is a paradigm shift. There's no telling where the line is. We were redefining the line, unquote. Still feeling responsible for the violence provoked, he sees conditions in China now even worse in terms of freedom. The Chinese regime today is the largest, most brutal mafia structure known to mankind, Shen Tong told Amnesty International. Quote, the 1980s held much more promise. As horrible as it was less brutal than today, unquote. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now a song about not forgetting by the late Nancy Lamott. Her voice so calm, the nervous red kitten I took home nearly 20 years ago, that he kept her name and memory alive until his passing last week. Lamott, a good pal.
And be the same as I was before. Darling, no, no, I can't anymore. It's too